from Burbank, California, where robots have sex with teens. It's the Mark Maron Show. And now, his bucket is full of rust. Mark Maron!
Oh, my gut is full of ice cream. That's what my bucket's full of. Holy crap. Good evening, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives, pain sponges, need machines, psychic vampires, the lot of you. And, of course, our fans. Man, that music's going on forever. I didn't even know it went on that long.
Yeah.
If it could go on that long before, why didn't you just make it that long before? Look at that. We're wearing our hats. We're all full of ice cream and pizza. Z-Girl, Zoe, and Pedro, big fans of the show, sent us all Kentucky Derby hats. And I'm all excited like a little kid. And a styrofoam container full of like 6 pints of, I guess it's called Grater's ice cream from Ohio. The best ice cream I've ever tasted.
Yeah, man, that's like great.
Man, this is riveting radio. That's a great thing about having 2 days left of a show.
My tongue is still burning from that ice, though.
You weren't supposed to eat the dry ice, I told you.
Really?
I'm surprised we were able to get it off without there being more damage.
Well, yeah.
That was crazy. For a second, it was cool when the smoke came out of your mouth, but then it got scary. I thought we were going to have to go to the hospital. Who the hell eats dry ice?
That would be good radio.
Yeah, it would just follow you to the hospital and say, yeah, why is his mouth smoking? Because he thought that was you can't eat that, Jim. You can put it in soda, or put it in your Halloween punch. Did you ever go to a party when you were a kid and the Halloween punch and they put the dry ice?
Never allowed to go out to parties.
Oh boy,
man.
We're driving the topic into the ditch.
It was great ice cream though.
Yes, great ice cream. Because I don't understand how the hell you make soft chocolate chunks in frozen ice cream. But Zoe and Pedro. The cat, she sent us Pop Rocks and these hats and some Kleenexes, so when we got all weepy, or maybe when you got weepy, we would be able to blow our nose and wipe our eyes a little bit. And also, this guy David, is that David? That's his name, right? David? I think that's his name. Hold on a minute. Yeah, sure enough, David dropped off a big bunch of Fluffernutter and sandwich stuff over at KTLK. Maybe we'll be able to get that. This is the second batch he sent. Someone took the Fluffernutter that he sent us. This is what you get. This is what you get when you end a show gracefully and with a certain amount of dignity, is you get people that say, those guys deserve to be fat. Let's send them stuff they can eat. Huh?
Dignity?
How come you...
Dignity.
I am trying to convince myself, Jim, that we're going out with a certain amount of aplomb. Is that the word?
Aplomb? Eve of plum?
Look, we had no choice. We did a great show. It's just it's our lot in life, Jim, to be cult heroes. Hey, you ever heard of Mark Maron and Jim Earl? No, what the hell did they do? They did this radio show, dude. You have to go to the Snot Green Sea and hear it.
In Wikipedia.
Wikipedia. Look at Wikipedia. Yeah, it's under the Screwed Twice column at Wikipedia. But look, man, we're going to be okay. We're probably going to podcast out of my garage. I got a lot of equipment that Bill made me buy. I don't know if I'm going to be able to get rid of it. Right when we got here, man, right when Bill got here, this is going to cost you about $10,000 to rig this garage up to fly. We can fly in my garage right now. So I got, if anybody needs a Telos, I got one of those. Is that what it's called? A Telos for ISDN hookup. I could do a radio show out of my garage right now if somebody wanted one.
I could use all that equipment. I'm thinking of joining Al-Qaeda.
Al-Qaeda from...
get better funding, strangely enough, with Al-Qaeda.
From Angelino Heights?
Yeah.
Yeah, because they're not... they've got a long-term vision. You know what I mean? They're not this...
They have good leadership, long-term vision. They know what they're doing.
Yeah, they're not a bunch of investors that are worried about dumping a bunch of money and making a quick turn on the profit.
They get results.
They get results, and they're willing to wait until the end of time.
You got to respect that. You know, even if you don't agree with their philosophy, you got to respect results.
Well, that's right. A lot of people feel that way about Hitler. They said, you know, as wrong as that guy was and as evil as he was, he had a hell of a sense of fashion, and he almost made Europe German.
Hugo T. Boss dressed Hitler.
Nuh-uh.
Yeah.
Get the hell out of here.
Okay, see ya.
Wait, did he really?
Bye.
Come back, Jim. How am I being gullible? Hugo Boss?
Yeah, Hugo Boss.
He's the guy that makes the suits.
That was his company.
Really?
That was his company. The SS and Hitler, everybody.
Is he screwing with me?
No, look it up. Look it up.
Hugo Boss, because I have a few of his shirts and a couple of his jackets.
His company.
I had no idea that the swastika on my suit was like the original guy that made that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Hugo Boss, really?
Yeah.
Okay, man.
I'm pretty sure about that. Now you're making me doubt myself, but I'm no. If it's not Hugo Boss, it's another major German company, fashion company that we all know about. But I'm pretty sure it's Hugo.
I'm trying to just buffer myself from looking like an idiot because it can work both ways. Either you're right and you've been vindicated, or else my constantly saying, "Really, Hugo Boss?" is just like me saying, "I'm an idiot," over and over and over again.
Why don't we just change it to "You're an idiot"? Just say "You're an idiot."
I'm an idiot, Jim.
Yeah.
I am an idiot. Yeah. Anything to make you feel better. Is there anything else you want me to do? Because I'll tell you what, this is your day, Jim. My day? You just tell me what you want me to do to make you feel better, and I'll try to do that.
I want you to do a dance where you kick yourself in the back of the head.
Well, no, I can't do impossible things, but I'll, I'm an idiot. How's that? Is that working?
Yeah, you like it? It's kind of making me laugh.
I'm an idiot, all right? Oh, God, this is great radio.
No, we got John Dean on today.
That's going to be interesting because I read his book, Worse Than Watergate, and it was just a scathing indictment, primarily of Dick Cheney and the policies of secrecy that this administration has embarked on because of Dick Cheney. Now, his new book, Conservatives Without a Conscience, is really about what he used to believe conservatism was. And how, which was basically Barry Goldwater. Apparently, he wanted to write this book with Barry Goldwater. And I don't really. It's weird when you have conservatives on. We had an opportunity to have Richard Viguerie on, and I just didn't want to deal with it. I'll talk to if we had callers, I'd talk to conservative people. But this guy, John Dean, worked for probably the most Machiavellian, secretive, authoritarian Republican of all time, Nixon. He took a hit for it, and he's reassessed his life, and is now a true critic of governmental policy in terms of how this particular group of Republicans has evolved and completely could care not about democracy, the people, or anything but power, and are willing to do anything to maintain and get it. So that'd be interesting. He's a guy who knows. We also have Lon Friend, who wrote a book called Life on Planet Rock. This guy used to be the editor of Rip Magazine here in Los Angeles, and he was it was a seminal rag in the time of like Guns N' Roses coming about, Metallica coming about, caught some of Nirvana. He was like the metal guy here in L.A., but it was an important magazine, and he wrote a book about all his stories, and there's nothing better than rock stories. I hope he's got some good drug stories, because drug stories are the good ones, I think. War stories, what I'm saying? Then there was that other time I almost died. All right, Ellen Perry, who is the director of The Fall of Fujimori. Fujimori, did you know who this guy was?
Yeah, Peru.
I'm an idiot. I mean, literally, it was one of those times where I watched this thing, and I'm like, how could I not know about this? And I realized, because I didn't give a crap until maybe 4 years ago about anything.
You know why?
Why? Because I'm an idiot. All right, Jim. I know this is going to turn bad eventually. But you just keep hitting it. I'm going to be like, wait a minute.
Huh? Can you do more high pitch? I'm an idiot.
I'm an idiot.
Yeah, I like that.
I hurt my voice. Yeah, Fujimori, the documentary is awesome. It's going to be on PBS next week. She's going to be in studio. Mishna Wolf, the brilliant comedian, who is going to be doing her one-person show, I'm Down, here in Los Angeles at the beginning of August. We're getting the plug in because she knows somebody here at the station. And also, this is the last show, so we got to do it now, tomorrow or the next day. They're not going to be able to plug it before. It's an excellent show, and I know her very well because she lives in my house. She makes my house the perfect place to live. How do you like that? I love her because she's smart and funny and really good at spilling things. I'm kidding. It's going to be fun. So what else you got, Jim? Tomorrow we're going to San Diego.
Yeah, that's
the last show. Don't expect any news today, folks, except from we're going to talk to John Dean, as I said, and we'll definitely learn something with Ellen Perry about Fujimori and about conservatives and stuff. But no topical stuff. We're just going to lay back and digest ice cream. I haven't eaten like that in so long. Mark Grau. This is our last day with Laughing Andy and the Mark Grau family here. They bought these pizzas. Have you ever seen a pizza that big?
No, I never.
What the hell was that? I saw it coming in on the video monitor. I'm like, wow, this really distorts things. And then I got there and gotten back, and the pizza's as big as like a carpet.
They were delivered in a Humvee.
They were.
Big pizza.
Are you serious?
No.
Am I, Joey Gullible today?
Yeah.
I'm ridiculous. You're like, Calvin Klein was invented by.
He was T-Boss. Look it up.
I'm going to look it up. It is? You validated it? Okay, we've got to talk to John Dean here, which you'll hear after the next segment, but we're going to do it now. So stay with us. This is the Mark Maron Show, and it's the wheels are coming off, Jim. It's okay. We've got 2 days. The wheels can come off, can't they?
Of course.
I was listening to some Dwight Yoakam earlier. He's pretty good.
Dwight Yoakam.
He's no hack.
No.
Be back in a second.
Keeps his face in a jar by the door, Mark Maron.
I'm high on ice cream, man. Soft chocolate chips and ice cream. How the hell did they even do that? That stuff that Zoe sent us, unbelievable.
We made ice cream last night.
You did?
Yeah, I just put strawberries in there, strawberry ice cream. Yeah.
Wait,
we made homemade vanilla ice cream, put strawberries in there.
All right. Since our president is openly operating in a different reality, we think it's important that listeners know what's going on in his alternate universe. Luckily, we have a staffer who lives in that world. So here now, one last time, is our very own Planet Bush Bureau Chief, Lawton Smalls. Hello, Lawton.
God's making some programming changes, and you just got switched over to Christian Inspirational. Welcome aboard,
all
son.
All right. Yeah, well, so I guess you've heard we've been canceled, right?
Yes, Mark, and I just want to say how sorry I am. I truly am.
Well, thanks for that, I think.
Tell me something, Mark.
Yeah.
Did you really think a show dedicated to lib-flopping, baby-killing, defeat-a-crat propaganda could ever compete with the L.A. Clippers? Or even the Sparks? A bunch of 7-foot lesbians playing basketball is more popular than liberal radio programming. Now, what does that tell you?
I don't know. I don't know that the people in L.A. really like basketball.
It says the left is hopelessly out of the mainstream, marginalized and impotent, a fading hippie stain on America's spotless white underpants. Of course, I foretold the end of this show months ago. It came to me in a vision.
Right, well, in a vision. So what are you, a psychic, one of Nancy Reagan's astrologers?
Oh, Mark, where will you put your sarcasm when this is all over, I wonder.
Yeah.
Poor Mishnah.
Uh-huh.
But I'm not a psychic or some gypsy astrologer. The Lord has blessed me with second sight, you know, the gift.
Mm-hmm.
Just like Kate Blanchett in that movie where Katie Holmes takes her shirt off, that dirty little whore. I'm a prophet, Mark. Prophet.
Uh-huh.
Jeremiah, Isaiah, Smalls.
Okay.
That's how it works.
Right. Well, I'm glad to know you're not taking yourself too seriously there, Lawton. So, okay, wow, all right. So I'm here with a prophet. Tell me the future,
yep.
Holy man. Maybe I can place some bets on this. So who wins the 2008 election, Prophet Smalls?
Oh, there won't be one. By popular acclaim, the people decide that President George W. Two Terms Mandate Bush should become President George W. Unlimited Terms Even More Powerful Mandate Bush. President for life, that kind of deal. You know, that's the last thing Congress does before it's dissolved.
Oh, okay. All right. So who's running everything?
The Sturch. You know, Republicans finally privatized everything into one efficient military, industrial, religious media complex.
Huh.
And let me tell you something. It is paradise. No more oppressive taxes for the rich. No more government handouts for lazy liberals. No more public schools, public TV, public radio, public highways, public parks, public internet, public anything, basically. Everything is Sturch-owned. Sturch operated. The only thing that isn't private are your phone conversations and your email.
Oh, my God.
You know, we got life sentences, prison sentences for drugs,
uh-huh.
obscene language, abstract expressionist paintings, long hair, hip-hop, that kind of thing.
Mm.
No more bad news, no more negativity, no more defeatocrats, no more First Amendment, no more abortion, no more Islam, no more Susan Sarandon, no more gay agenda. Shoot, no more gays. Period. America's one big happy family, Mark, working 60 hours a week for the Sturch, eating big giant meals for the Sturch, watching TV for the Sturch, and even dying for the Sturch. And in charge of it all, sitting right next to Bush, wearing a blue Oxford cloth shirt and Dockers, is Jesus.
All right, okay.
There he is.
All right, stop.
Perfect.
Stop. Enough of that. You know, what about me? Let's get to the important part. What happens to Mark Maron?
Well, you're in Canada.
Thank God. If Bush is president for life, that's exactly where I want to be.
Mark, you don't understand. You're in Canada because Bush liberated it just like he did to Iraq, and the church is establishing a democracy there. Mexico, too. Everyone does 5 years of mandatory service in the church based on, you know, of course, income, race, and previous political affiliation. You chose to serve as a Canadian peacekeeper instead of going to jail after you were convicted for treason. But cheer up. You're going to love Saskatchewan in the winter. It's great.
All right. Okay. All right. Well, after that, what about my show business career?
Well, this is funny. You picked that one yourself.
Uh-huh.
As Mark the Shark, you'll be 100 times more popular than you are now with all those funny sound effects and farting and all. I just laugh. Everyone loves Mark the Shark. You're a star, buddy.
Okay.
Relax.
All right. Well, what about you, Auden? What happens to you, man?
Me?
Yeah.
What happens to me?
Yeah, what happens to you?
What happens to me? What happens to me?
Oh, yeah.
They won't let me in the building.
Wait, what do you mean? What won't let you into what building?
KTLK.
Yeah.
When I heard the show got canceled, I sold my house on Planet Bush and bought a ticket to Los Angeles.
Uh-huh.
I'm outside your studio right now.
Oh.
You can't leave me again, Mark. You can't leave me again.
Oh,
take me home with you. I'm outside, and I'm cold, and I'm hungry.
Oh, man. Yeah, you know, you really shouldn't have done that, Lawton.
Just for a couple of days, please.
No, I don't.
I'll get my own place. I'll feed your cats. I'll be doing whatever you want. Don't leave.
All right, okay. Just pull it together. Pull it together. After the show, we'll get something to eat, okay? We'll get something
really?
To eat. Yeah, we'll get some Mexican food. Just stop crying.
I'm allergic to soy.
Well, we
so
won't.
You know I can't have it.
All right, well, we'll get some Mexican food or something. No soy, no healthy stuff.
Liberal radio is dead, Mark. Just throw some dirt on it and move on.
All right,
we're done.
Goodbye.
We're done.
Goodbye, Lawton.
Hey, God loves you, Mark. Deal with it.
All right. In just a second, we got John Dean coming up next to talk about, he's one of them, but he's a smart one of them, and his heart's in the right place right now. Stay tuned.
And now, there is a cancer on this radio show. Mark Maron.
Thank you, sir. John Dean, my friends, was the White House counsel for Richard Nixon. He was a chief minority counsel for the House Judiciary Committee and an associate deputy attorney general in the Department of Justice. So, in other words, he knows how it all works. His last book, Worse Than Watergate, was a searing indictment primarily of Dick Cheney, who, of course, deserved it. And his newest book, Conservatives Without Conscience, he examines what has gone wrong with conservatism, but more importantly, what the hell is wrong with the idiots in power now. Welcome to the show, John Dean.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
I'm good. I'm very excited to talk to you because, first of all, I don't talk to many conservatives, period. and the reason I'm excited to talk to you, I read your last book, and it really... You know, throughout that entire book, I kept saying, "Yeah, get him, John." And I liked the way he took Dick Cheney down.
Well, you know, it was like the new book. In that book, I started talking about secrecy before of that administration, before the mainstream media picked it up.
Uh-huh.
I couldn't understand why they didn't pick it up. Just like in the material I wrote in this new book, they're not talking about it, and I can't understand why. So I'm trying to get... today, everybody talks about the extreme secrecy of this Bush presidency. I'm hoping tomorrow everybody will be talking about the authoritarianism that's now crept in and taken control of Republican politics.
Well,
let's talk about this specifically and go back to where you started with this book, because you originally intended to write this book with Barry Goldwater, who at the time you guys came up with the idea was aging and ailing. And just for my own information, because I don't really understand, I'm a reactionary liberal person. What was it about Barry Goldwater as a conservative that was so impressive? How did he define it for you?
Well, he's somebody I had known literally since I was 13 years of age. I knew him right shortly after he entered the Senate. His son and I are best friends. We happened to be roommates back then in prep school. So I've known the senator for virtually my entire life. I dealt with him a lot in both business and pleasure in Washington, so I really got to know the man's thinking. I think he was somebody who's pretty misjudged. I think the senator today would probably be seen as left of center. I know that, you know, my views have changed very little in the last 40 years, and I'm certainly left of the Republican Party. In fact, I registered as an independent a number of years ago because I didn't recognize anything that party had to offer. So what happened is we were talking in 1994 about the fact that something was terribly wrong with conservatism. There was the incivility. There were the absolutely senseless and vicious attacks against Bill and Hillary Clinton, which the senator said, hey, I'm going to blast these people because they're driving people out of politics. This makes no sense. Give this guy a chance. It hurts the country when you hurt the presidency.
Well, yeah. Well, so let's because that's interesting. Because you worked, you know, in the book, you cite that most Republicans in power came into being as politicians, you know, post Nixon,
right.
And many of them were bearing a deep resentment and desire for payback for what happened to Nixon, and in the name of that. That payback, they've sacrificed any decorum or sense of duty to the people or to the system of government.
I'll tell you, Mark, when I really, really realized that is when I came back here during the Clinton impeachment.
Uh-huh.
I'm back in Washington right now. You know, I'm normally based in California, but I came back for the longest time I'd been in 25 years back here. I was back here for almost 4 months during that, working for MSNBC, and I was constantly in the green room or on the set, and through that green room passed virtually everybody who was involved, who was anybody, in the impeachment. So I had chances to talk to these people, you know, off the record. It's not the sort of thing I would quote, even though I made a journal of a lot of it, just for my own edification, because I couldn't believe what they were doing. For example, the week before the House impeachment inquiry starts, there's a poll in the Washington Post that says 60% of the Republican Party does not want anybody to go forward and try to impeach this president. So I asked these people who were streaming through the green room, the hard right people, I said, why in the hell are you going forward with this? I said, well, 30% do want it, and that's our base, and we believe our base is right, and so we're going to push this. So the base has long been driving the party, and the base is the authoritarian element of in conservatism.
But you're saying that authoritarian in the matter of, you're talking about the religious fanatic theocrats who are authoritarian in the nature of biblical zealots.
Let me back up just a little bit and tell you when you know, yes, the senator had to drop out of the project. I put it on the shelf when he was feeling bad, and I thought I'd get it back down, and then he passed away, and I didn't stop looking. And what I finally found was a body of information I didn't know exist, that empirical studies that really started in the aftermath of World War II, where social scientists became concerned as to whether what happened in Germany and Italy under Hitler and Mussolini could happen in the United States. So this study started of, you know, why, who are these people? And they were labeled authoritarian followers. Right-wing authoritarian followers.
Well, right, and what we're seeing now, I think, and this is one of my biggest fears. I've got a woman coming on the show after you who directed a documentary about Alberto Fujimori. And in that documentary, it's very similar to what we're talking about now, just how easily it can happen. Because, you know, I talk a lot about this on the show. You cite an alliance of the Republican power structure with the religious right, and Goldwater said this was dangerous and frightening. And now, you know, and Eisenhower feared the military-industrial complex. Now we have a religious-industrial complex. And it just seems to me that in the evolution of conservatism that you're talking about, that it's almost unavoidable that this place fall into some sort of dictatorship or theocracy.
Well, we're not there yet, and that's the reason I wrote the book, is to raise the flag, put the warnings out. I wrote this book as much for conservatives as I did for liberals, moderates, anybody else who's interested in the process. If we understand this, hopefully the most of America is centrist, no question. And those in the center can keep the, you know, anyone on the extreme right or left from getting too far offline, because this country seems to operate best when we're in the center. Yes, you need the left and the right. They sort of balance each other, but now that's become the polarized debate, and I'm hopeful to get the center back involved where they understand what's happening on the far right, which I find fairly frightening.
Well, what you're talking about also is, it seems to me that you have these people that may not necessarily be these religious people that are exploiting this base and exploiting people through wedge issues. And I think that when you talk about authoritarians and also these devious kind of these evil Republicans without conscience, many of them know exactly what they're doing by manipulating these people, right?
Absolutely. There are two types of authoritarians, Mark. Mm-hmm. There are the leaders and the dominators, and there are the followers of the herd. And the leaders are amoral. They're dominating personalities. They're primarily men. And they will do what is ever necessary to get themselves and the ideas they believe ahead. There is just nothing that is out of the realm for them. They're mean-spirited. Now, these aren't my labels, incidentally. These are the labels that they put on themselves in literally hundreds of thousands of anonymous testings that have been done over the last 40, 50 years. So it's not me laying pejorative names on them. This is what, when you look at their responses, they're largely these are anonymous tests, so they're very open and candid about their thinking and their attitudes, and you find this is really proto-fascist behavior. Now, as I say, we're not there yet, but we're so close to it that I'm trying to warn people, you've got to be careful.
Now, even Nixon, I mean, these guys are something above and beyond. They're almost hyper-Nixonian in their Machiavellian momentum here.
Well, I think Nixon could probably run as a Green today. But at one point I say in the book that, you know, comparatively speaking, Nixon had a conscience as opposed to Bush and Cheney. I can't envision Richard Nixon ever calling for, endorsing, or seeking torture. In his darkest moment, he's a man who served in the service. He was in the Navy. He knew what the fighting was about. He knew the repercussions that torture can have on our troops. He saw it during My Lai and had no tolerance for it at all. He saw it, you know, from both the highest and as well as the ground level. There's just no way Nixon would tolerate a vice president who goes and lobbies the Senate for torture. And he would be appalled to have George Bush offer his first major veto to kill McCain's amendment that would prohibit torture. It's really quite remarkable.
And when Nixon overreached, he got slapped down and ruined politically. And when these guys overreach, they just seem to change the rules. And it's really mind-blowing to me that I don't understand, you know, I guess when I read something like your book, where I really try to assess these people as human beings, is that they really don't care about anything other than maintaining power. And the thing that I don't quite understand is, outside of religious fanatics, what is it with regular people that find so much gratification in rallying behind these type of people?
They find safety. One of the things I found in reporting the book is how in the post 9/11 world, a lot of people moved into the ranks of authoritarian right wing followers. It attracted them because they feel the safety of a dominant leader who will protect them. And this is something, as a result, the Bush-Cheney administration has played to the hilt. They have done nothing but constant fear-mongering in every election since 9/11. And they're doing it again in this off-year, or this midterm. It works. It is a formula that performs. I try to explain in the book, if you put terrorism in proportion to other dangers our species, if you will, or Americans, it really is, statistically, it's not a very terribly serious problem. Yes, we have a very serious issue to deal with, but it doesn't mean we throw out all our rights and liberties to deal with them. It's just not necessary. It doesn't even match and come close to matching the threat of the Cold War.
All right, so John Dean, just let's talk about from a nonpartisan point of view or an independent point of view, who are some of the good guys?
Well, I'll tell you, when you look at the vote, let's take as a good litmus test the vote on the McCain amendment to prohibit torture. 90 members of the Senate said no. 9 members, who I happen to add to a footnote, hoping that shameful vote that voted for terrorism will track them the rest of their life, are not very good guys. These are clearly dangerous authoritarians. The 122 members of the House voted for torture. I think that's one quick sort of soundbite, brief answer for you.
Okay.
But I lay a lot of them out in the book.
Now, in terms of obviously the greatest criminals of conscience is well documented in your last book. But in terms of somebody like, you know, George Bush, who was driving this ship, you know, what do you think of him psychologically? I mean, what is your instincts about, you know, what that guy's capable of? We obviously seen what he allows to happen. And,
Mark, if the social scientist had developed a scale for authoritarianism on a, say, a 10-point basis, which they haven't, but I'm generalizing now, you could put Bush at about a 6.
Yeah.
Cheney, however, would be a 10 out of a 10-pointer.
And he is really the most dangerous threat to probably the world right now, isn't he?
He is somebody that must be watched.
Is anybody watching him, John Dean?
Only one. He only reports to one person.
Who, Lynn?
No, well, maybe yes. Maybe Lynn and Mary, but also his boss, in theory, is George Bush. But I think that, you know, Bush is clearly not a heavyweight. Cheney can run circles around him. He runs an operation that is far more sophisticated. The vice president's staff is more sophisticated than the White House staff. And as I say in the book, the vice presidency has swallowed the president in this instance.
Now, in terms of some of the sort of dyed-in-the-wool conservatives that believe that Bush is just a nightmare, is there hope that they will speak up and start to at least create a real schism in the Republican Party that might re-engage checks and balances?
I sent the manuscript of this book to some well-known, very solid, hard-right conservatives who are people I've known for years.
Yeah.
I said, give it to me straight. What do you think? And they said, John, thank you for using the A word. We're worried about that also. So there are people, they're not going to come public on this, but I'm telling you, in their heart, they know what is right and what is wrong.
And the A word is?
Authoritarianism.
Okay. All right. Well, I tend to call it, fascism, crypto-fascism, Christo-fascism, but authoritarianism, that's good, too. Thank you, John Dean, for joining us.
I think
the book is a must-read for anybody who cares about what is going on, because you certainly have been inside one of the worst of them.
Well, I'm delighted. It's number one on both Barnes & Noble and Amazon.
Okay. Take care of yourself.
Bye-bye.
Bye. All right. It was okay that I was nice, wasn't it? Here we go. What do we? What's up next? Okay, I don't have my thing in front of me. Bruce Cherry's pitch of the week. Is he coming in? All right. Cool. Oh, there he is. Look at the Zero Mostel sideburn looking mother. Okay, folks, longtime listeners know that our next guest has been trying, dare I say, heroically, to come up with a recurring character for the show. All of his efforts have been spurned with a callousness that borders on cruelty. Only now do I see how blind I was. Too late, alas, too late. At least I let him write his own introductions. Please welcome Bruce Cherry.
Thank you, Mark. You know, you once gave me some sage advice.
And what was that, Bruce?
A pinch of rubbed sage adds a new layer of flavor to traditional pasta sauce.
And using fusilli adds a funky twist to the presentation. Hey, Bruce, have you got one last character for us?
Oh, yeah. It's a throwback to the very, very beginning of Morning Sedition.
Ah.
Recall a character called Conspiracy Guy?
Oh, yes.
Yep, saw plots and everything. It was loosely based on your own paranoia.
Hey, who said I'm paranoid?
This character is just the opposite.
No, seriously, is somebody going around telling people I'm paranoid?
This guy is a coincidence theorist. He doesn't see conspiracies anywhere.
Huh. Wait, somebody close to me is trying to bring me down, I think.
One last time. Let's go to script.
Hey, Bruce, cut the pretense. We're at the end of page 2 here.
Whatever. Just continue.
Folks, our next guest is a noted coincidence theorist, Mr. Abraham Lincoln. That's an unusual name. Did your parents name you after the president?
Not at all. It was sheer coincidence. My family was as shocked as anyone to learn I shared a name with our 16th president.
Well, Abe, I understand you have a novel theory about the assassination of President Kennedy.
Assassination my ass. Let's be real. This was an incredible, if unfortunate, coincidence. here's how I see it. This Lee Harvey Oswald, just a small-time textbook thief. And on the morning of November 22, 1963, he snuck into the Dallas Schoolbook Depository to steal some volumes of 8th grade math.
Hmm.
He was perusing a text called Fun with Integers when the presidential motorcade happened by. At that moment, from the general direction of the building, a small but intense meteor shower hit. A bullet-sized and shaped meteor passed completely through Governor Connally before killing the incredibly unlucky President Kennedy.
Wow, so this isn't exactly a single-bullet theory.
It's a no-bullet theory. You gotta look at things logically. Take 9/11. It wasn't a government plot. It wasn't even a terrorist plot. Heart disease is the number one killer in America. It only makes sense to assume that a pilot in mid-flight on that ill-fated morning succumbed to this common killer. Luckily, or unluckily as it turned out, some Arabs who had been taking flying lessons were on the plane. Seizing the chance to save some lives, they took control of the cockpit. But their aviation skills not up to the task. In a desperate attempt to land at LaGuardia, they flew the plane directly into one of the Twin Towers.
Well, that's one.
If it's reasonable to assume that happened, hey, it's reasonable to assume that the exact same thing happened again at roughly the same time. Except those heroic Saudis managed to miss the flaming first tower, unaware that their evasive maneuvers would take them directly into the second tower. Sad, really. I mean, what are the odds?
All right, well, what about the plane that struck the Pentagon?
Ah, that, I believe, was a weather balloon.
I take it you don't believe in Bigfoot.
Bigfoot? Mark, I don't believe in white-tailed deer. There's simply no way that a creature that size can be roaming the woodlands of North America without ever being detected.
But hunters kill tens of thousands of deer a year.
Exactly. Hunters. Most of whom have a high school education or less. Exactly the kind of people given to superstition and tall tales.
All right. So what are these creatures they have tied to the hoods of their trucks every hunting season?
Yeah, probably a gazelle escaped from a nearby zoo. Or an 800-pound house cat. These stories of deer just strain belief, Mark.
All right, and there are no unidentified flying objects?
There are no identified flying objects. All these wild tales of birds and planes. It's mass hysteria. Think about it. People in airports are in a hurry. They don't have time to properly observe the phenomena they think they see. When one of them says they saw an airplane or they took an airplane to Houston, they're just repeating things they've seen in the media.
All right, look, Bruce, I don't think I can give you a recurring character, but it may be some consolation to know that I won't be recurring either.
Hey, Mark, look, it's my last appearance. Let's tell your audience the truth. I am a recurring character.
Right.
There is no Bruce Cherry.
All right. Okay, why not come clean? Why don't you tell them what your real name is, John? I mean, Bruce.
Well, there goes the surprise. My real name is John Kelly Street, which can be shortened, of course, to Johnny K Street. When Mike Ferrucci told me he was going to make up a character using my real name, I decided to create Bruce Cherry.
All right, you might as well start using your real voice, John.
Good point, Mark. It's nice to not have to speak in that vaguely foppish patois, but I just want to tell you how great it's been to appear every week on your show as my alter ego, Bruce Cherry.
Hey, man, it was great having you. Bruce Cherry, everybody.
It follows me, baby.
All right. We will be back with Ellen Perry. Stay with us.
Whip Inflation Now with Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. On July 18th on PBS, you will be able to watch POV's presentation of the fall of Fujimori. It's about the rise and fall of Alberto Fujimori, the president of Peru through the 90s, right? Yeah. The story involves a war on terrorism, the suspension of the Constitution, an aggressive demonic right-hand man to the president. Does that sound familiar? It is an encapsulation of an abuse of power and how quickly what is called democracy can become tyranny and dictatorship. The director of the film, Ellen Perry, premiered the film at Sundance last year. It was nominated for the Writers Guild Best Screenplay for a Documentary Award and will be airing on PBS, as I said, July 18th next week. Welcome to the show, Ellen.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you, and I got to be honest with you. Before I watched your documentary, I had no idea who Alberto Fujimori was because I was not really, politically awakened till a few years ago. But why did you decide to use him as a topic?
Well, first of all, because he's a fascinating character. I mean, he's absolutely tragic on every level. But most importantly, after 9/11, I felt that his story was really relevant to America's story in our sort of Bush's war on terror. In the case of Fujimori, when he was elected in 1990, Peru was in social and economic chaos. Inflation was over 7,000%, which is absolutely mind-boggling. There were two insurgent groups, one of them Shining Path, the other the MRTA, who are most famous for taking over the Japanese embassy in 97. But within 2 years of his election, he closed the Congress. He mounted an autogolpe, a self-coup, and usurped the judiciary, implemented military tribunals. He also engaged in fraudulent elections and did this all in the name of battling terrorism.
It's pretty fascinating because this was a guy that the people loved, and because now not the threat of terror or the threat of these groups, I guess the Shining Path actually had a shot at taking over the government.
They controlled 40% of the nation.
Right. So this was a country that was sort of subverting a civil war to some degree. Mm-hmm. And these actions that he took in terms of, like, literally he had senators arrested?
Yeah, I mean, he literally on in April of 1992, he literally closed the Congress. He rewrote the Constitution. He shut down the judiciary. He took over the press.
And that sounds incredibly familiar.
Very familiar. And the people supported him because the nation was in such dire straits and people were living in fear.
Now, in you got to talk to this guy because he's obviously still alive and he's in exile and he's a wanted criminal to a certain degree, right, in his country.
He's on Interpol's most wanted list, yes.
Now, I guess the big question is, how does something like this, you know, in your experience of it, the guy, his right-hand man, what was that guy's name?
Vladimir Montesinos.
Now, it seemed to me that the alliance between the two of them, Fujimori keeps claiming that, you know, he didn't know what was going on, but he had to know what was going on. But obviously, this guy was the mastermind of what happened, right?
Yes, he was his Rasputin, his Svengali, yes.
And what began to happen is that the corruption, the symbiotic relationship between this evil genius, who was this guy who was doing death squads and he was doing all this subversive, bloody, you know, killing of what he claimed to be terrorists, was able to, you know, almost like take over this leader.
Totally.
And that seems to be similar to what's happening with Bush and Cheney a lot.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So in terms of what you're trying to say, what did you come away with this experience in how you look at America?
Well, I mean, I just think it's really important to always to have checks and balances.
Right.
And certainly, I mean, the recent decision with the Supreme Court in honoring the Geneva Convention in terms of Guantanamo Bay, I mean, our democratic institutions are much more stable here in this country. However, as each year has passed under the Bush administration, I mean, he wants more and more power within the executive branch.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, our forefathers decided that was not a good thing. We already had a King George and that we broke away from, and we already had our own little revolution here. And there needs to be separation of power in this country. And we have the judiciary, we have the legislative, and we have the executive. And in Fujimori's case, he controlled everything. Him and Montesinos.
But he seemed like he struck me as a fairly intelligent guy. I mean, Bush, you know, some people claim he's intelligent, some people not. But this Fujimori guy,
he's brilliant.
Yeah, he seemed like he was very much on top of it. He was very deceptive.
Mm-hmm.
He was able to charm the people in a way that Bush couldn't. And there didn't seem to be, like you have here, which I think makes it possible here, either you didn't talk about it or there wasn't really a religious component. I know there was a poverty component and an indigenous culture component, but there wasn't a religious component to exploit. Just horrendous poverty.
Absolutely. But, you know, in this country, I think just recently the stat came out that 1% of the wealth is controlled, or what is it, 40% of the wealth of this country is controlled
by
1%
right.
of this country.
Yeah.
When you look at something like that, I mean, you're talking about, you know, the gap between the rich and poor getting greater and greater and greater. And that's certainly the case in Peru. I mean, the indigenous people are greatly disenfranchised and impoverished. And Fujimori was elected based on his representation of those people.
And then there was the weird element of his wife. What happened with that? His wife, that seemed like, I understood that there was a scandal, and I understand that they were living in the same house and that she started to run against him mm-hmm. in an election, mm-hmm. And he didn't seem to know it, although they were living in the same house together. Mm-hmm. What really happened with all that, and what was that about?
Well, it's that's a very sad part of the film. You know, they were married for 20 years. She bore 4 children with him, and within 3 years of their relationship after he became president, she wanted out because she didn't recognize the man that she'd been living with for the last 20 years.
Well, he was kind of a math geek almost, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. Yeah, exactly.
And she was too, right?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden now he's got this weird evil genius guy killing people in the streets. I imagine that if that doesn't turn her on, it's probably going to turn her off.
Right. I mean, Fujimori went through a tremendous transformation and Susanna, I mean, many people think that Susanna's kind of out of her mind too, and
yeah.
that she was jealous of Montesinos and jealous of the attention that Fujimori was getting. So, you know, but ultimately it is extremely bizarre, which is why I think, you know, the film is just Shakespearean.
It definitely is, because it's interesting that in the interviews that he's a respected guy.
Very much.
I mean,
so.
Fujimori is the most frightening thing about all of it, is that on the speaking circuit, this guy is some sort of genius who turned his country around, successfully fought terrorism, despite the fact that, you know, he usurped any sort of democratic process.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
For how many years did that go on for?
10 years.
Well, that's unbelievable to me. And the people respected him. People desire. I don't think people can really handle democracy for some reason. That the process of it, when people are frightened, they're so completely willing to go, screw it. You know, if what he's doing is working, I don't care if I have to be in my house at 8 and wear the silly hat.
It's all related, you know, and just in terms of, you know, how wealth is distributed, you know, how you know, our branches are divided, you know, the kind of people that we have in leadership, and certainly in the Bush administration and with Fujimori, they used terrorism to their benefit. Even after the heads of the terrorist organizations were captured, Fujimori, in his 2000 campaign, was still speaking about, you know, maintaining a sense of freedom and taking fear out of the common people, because terror still existed.
Oh, and
when it didn't.
And that part where he just said, you know, he can run again after he'd already been president for 2 terms, and he said, well, the new constitution didn't cover the first one.
It was completely unconstitutional.
It's like evil genius. And then when he caught that the crazy Marxist, the terrorist leader, what's that guy's?
He was a Maoist, Guzman.
The Guzman, and he puts him in like an old-timey kind of prison mm-hmm. with a striped shirt.
Mm-hmm.
And he literally, in the interview with you, he says, we didn't use that kind of prison garment, but I saw it in movies.
Exactly.
So I thought the image would be there. And they put him all by himself. And that was some sick.
Yeah, he's a really smart guy. He knows how to use the media for sure.
But do you think that he is? Do you think that Blood is on his hands in a criminal way? You seem to be somewhat sympathetic to him. Do you think that he should be tried for war crimes? Do you think that?
Well, that's what's happening right now. I mean, he left Japan after a 4-year exile and was intercepted in Chile. He had hoped to run in the Peruvian elections this year.
You're kidding.
No.
They probably would have elected him, too, huh?
He was leading in the polls. His daughter was actually... Yeah, his daughter was...
Hey, Hitler's back! Yay!
Well, they did re-elect Alan Garcia, who certainly is no better than Fujimori.
Uh-huh.
He preceded Fujimori. He was president from 85 to 90 and is actually the reason why Peru was in the state that it was in when
right.
Fujimori was elected. But now Fujimori is detained in Chile, and the Peruvian judiciary have presented the Chilean court, Supreme Court, you know, all these documents, and they are going to try to extradite him.
So then he'll be thrown in prison with Montesino and Guzman, and they can
probably.
So what's Montesino doing? Montesino, his ex-intelligent guy, the guy who ran the death squads, is in prison right next to the Maoist leader. So they're probably putting together a coup right now. Is that possible?
I hope not.
Well, it's a phenomenal documentary, and I think everyone should watch it. It's on July 18th. That's next week. Ellen Perry, it was great talking to you.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming. It's The Fall of Fujimori. We'll be back with things, right? Yeah, my wife's here, Misha Wolf, and Lon Friend. We're going to talk rock and roll and things, funny stuff.
wearing the ambivalence patch, Mark Maron.
Yeah. I haven't even picked any jokes yet for later. That'll be fun.
You want me to pick them out?
Yeah, all right. Yeah, if you want, yeah. What are you just going to be sitting there anyways? Mm-hmm. Hey, all right, folks.
What was that?
I'm kidding. No, rip them up. No. Oh, Jim. We got an important caller. Let's be cool. Let's honor this guy for whatever reason. There's been a lot of mystery lately surrounding Tom Cruise's baby, Suri. She was born nearly 3 months ago, but no one's seen her. We've got Tom on the phone. As you know, he's a fairly frequent visitor to the show. He's going to talk about it. So, Tom, what's the story, man?
Where do I begin?
Well, your friends say they never seen her. Birth certificate wasn't signed for a month.
Right.
And the person who signed it wasn't even there when she was born. Come on, let's be straight with me. Does this baby even exist, Tom?
Yes, Mark. Believe me, she exists.
Well, what gives, pal? You have to admit, it's a little weird.
Okay, look, she's ugly, all right?
What?
She's butt ugly, Mark. Are you happy? I have a baby who looks like an ugly butt.
Hey, Tom, man, a lot of babies look sort of weird when they're born.
Oh, that's true, they do, but not this baby. She's just really ugly.
So it's a face only a mother could love.
No. Katie hates her, too.
Oh, man. Oh, no.
It was going to be a silent birth, as I'm sure you probably heard, but... Yeah. When she came out, I told Katie it was okay to scream.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't want to be hypocritical.
So that's why no one's seen her.
I was People Magazine's sexiest man alive in 1990, for God's sake.
And your fiancé is certainly a good-looking woman.
If you're into that kind of thing.
Well,
how did this happen, Mark? I'm a hunky guy.
All right, okay, but you do have unusual features, okay? You got the lopsided grin, you got the prominent nose, a weird squinty little eye.
I don't have a uninostril, Mark. Where'd she get that from, huh?
Still, Tom, come on, man. She's your daughter.
I know.
All right. You know what I think?
Yes. Cosmetic surgery. I was thinking the exact same thing.
No, that's not.
Doctors won't do it. It's so ridiculous and stupid. They're not going to make her look any worse.
But it could be a risk to her health, Tom.
Yeah, I know. That's what they said. It's an ethical issue. And then I thought, I know, I'll just trade her for an attractive baby, right?
You can't do that.
No, I know I can't. Believe me, I tried. First of all, most women won't even discuss trading babies.
Well, for obvious reasons.
I'm not talking about eating babies, Mark, all right?
Uh-huh.
It's not a bad deal for them. Exchange your attractive but insignificant baby for the child of the biggest star on the planet? That sounds pretty sweet to me!
Well, look, Tom, maybe in time you'll learn to love her.
No, I don't see that happening. I think it's just time for a clean slate. Hey, do you like kids?
I'm not going to take your daughter!
Come on! Oh, I'm so glad I got you canceled.
Wait a minute, what?
Nothing. Oh, she's so ugly.
All right, Tom, we're out of time. Take care of yourself.
I'll try.
Oh, man. He sounded just like my friend Dave, didn't he? Didn't he sound like Sevens? In studio right now, can she hear in her head? Oh, the lovely, talented, funny, genius comedian, Mishna Wolf, who I happen to know intimately.
Yeah.
Can I say I'm married to you? Is that allowed?
Sure.
Because I know sometimes...
You do every day. It's all you talk about.
What are you talking about?
It's all you talk about.
What, because I say, do you love me constantly?
No. Just on the air. Don't you... It seems like you talk about me a lot.
It boosts his career.
Yeah. I am... Are you kidding me? That when I took you to my high school reunion, that made everything worthwhile.
Thank you.
That was awesome.
Thank you.
You're like a trophy to him.
Go
ahead, ask her something.
No. I think that would fit if only you knew what we go through at home. Because, a trophy, theoretically, the trophy model, the trophy idea that doesn't really talk and has no personality. Mishna, on the other hand, is definitely wearing the pants. You understand?
But that's not true.
All right, you're wearing half the pants.
I'm wearing half the pants.
Yeah, we're doing one leg each kind of deal.
Yeah, one leg.
Yeah. So, Wolf, what you want to tell people about your show?
Yeah, I'm doing a show at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater.
Yeah.
Which is a fun, snazzy place where all the hip kids go.
Yeah.
And it's called I'm Down, My Life with Black People.
August 4th.
July 28th.
Really?
Uh-huh.
And way to 4th. Pay attention.
July 28th and August 4th. That's coming right up, huh?
Wow, are you ready?
I will be.
So what do you, why don't you tell the people a little bit about what does that mean, my life with black people?
Well, my dad, when we were growing up, my dad thought he was George Benson.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And we grew up in this like all black neighborhood. And my dad really, like, thought he was black.
Yeah.
And my sister, like, really thought he was she was black. And
yeah.
They were really integrated into this neighborhood. And then I was just super, really, really white.
Yeah, you were like a nerdy metal girl.
I was like nerdy metal girl. But even, like, before that, I was trying to be down, and I just could not seem to integrate at all. Like, even, like, I remember the first time my little sister called me a cracker, you know, just like, whoa, who set you on here?
And your sister, like, could not be whiter, really.
She couldn't, but she just was always sort of integrated into this community. I mean, we would go to Black Baptist Church every Sunday, you know, and she just loved it. She would raise her hands to the air and cry for Jesus.
Yeah.
She'd walk around the house singing, Jesus loves me. And
she's sort of cycling out of that now.
A little bit.
I'll never forget when you and I were first dating and we were having a fight on the phone and your sister gets on and I could literally hear her head nodding as she was yelling at me, you are not talking to my sister. I'm like, what is going on here? Who is this person?
You could hear the neck roll.
Yeah, the neck roll. That's
you,
what
you
I was
referring. You can. Yeah, no, it's funny. But my dad, it's mostly about my dad, and he's a pretty funny character. He used to Afrotech like everything in our house.
Yeah.
And just everything was jerry-rigged. Like, every drawer had like a special trick to opening it, and like to use a phone you had to stay perfectly still.
Yeah.
And he had his Mona Lisa was this van, and this was like a cargo van he used to transport four small children in.
Yeah.
And like you needed like a bent coat hanger to get in and out from the door, and the back doors were kept together with wire.
And there was some cinder blocks with a plank on it to sit down the back.
Better milk crates.
Oh, great. All right, so stay with us. Misha Wolf is here. We've got Lon Friend coming in to talk rock and roll. Misha's going to stay here because she's a rock and roll specialist. Stay with us.
And now, Mark Maron and Mishna finish the joke.
It's turned into a complete party atmosphere. The spine is broken out of the radio show. So we're going to talk to Lon Friend, who is here. We're playing this song in his honor.
You're going to be wearing some ink before the end of the day.
Okay. And Wolf, we were talking about her dad's van before we cut away to break. And we didn't quite get to the story where you were. Who was in the car with you guys?
It was the babies, which were his second wife, who was this black woman named Michelle. She had two kids, Mikiel and Michonne.
Yeah, and so you're all sitting on the milk crates in the back of the van.
We're all sitting on the milk crates in the back of the van, and my dad stops too fast, and one of the babies falls out of the milk, off of his milk crate, slides down the inside of the van, out the back doors, which were only kept together with the wire, you see. And he hits the pavement in the middle of traffic, so he gets up and starts chasing the van in traffic, screaming, don't leave me, you guys! Don't leave me! And my dad's got road rage, so he doesn't notice the babies chasing us for half a block. He's in the front of the van cursing.
Yeah.
Finally, the baby catches up with us, and he's all pissed off. He's like, you guys were going to leave me.
And where is that baby now?
I don't know. I just thought I'd ask.
Works in Bear Stearns.
I don't know.
So that is, Misha's going to be doing I'm Down July 28th and August 4th. On August 4th, I'm going to be doing the show
after
you.
Afterwards, huh?
So we'll have a big double bill.
Yeah.
But they're all going to come to see you. I'm just trying to work out some stuff. Folks, if you weren't familiar with the seminal Rip magazine, is that what you called it?
I didn't give it that name.
Okay. It was probably as important as Rolling Stone from the mid-80s to the mid-90s when bands like Guns N' Roses, Nirvana, Metallica were riding the wave of rock success. The editor of the magazine was Lon Friend. His new book, Life on Planet Rock, gives a first-hand look at a rock and roll life lived with candid encounters with a whole strew of rock gods, Nirvana, Metallica, Bon Jovi, Aerosmith, Alice Cooper. And we're talking on the break that you were on a bus with Jimmy Page.
Oh, boy.
Who was on that bus?
Jimmy Page, Steven Tyler, Joe Perry, and John Kolodner, the A&R guru from Geffen Records.
What the hell were y'all doing riding a bus in England?
I was just another journalist on the trip, but I arrived at the hotel to say hi to the guys. I had met Aerosmith earlier in the year, and Steven comes out of the bus, out of the hotel, and says, get on the bus, you're riding with us. I said, I am? Who am I riding with? Me? Joe, John, and Jimmy. And I looked down, I go, Jimmy? And out comes Jimmy Page from the revolving door.
Nice.
Went,
oh, my God.
And hair, you know, the hairs were up on my arm. And I went, okay. So, like, so much of my career, I just surrendered to the flow. And there I am for 4 hours, because it's a four-hour ride from London to Donington, the castle in the middle of nowhere where they have the Monsters of Rock Festival every
year.
Yeah. Dude.
80,000 kids show up and, you know, drunk and tatted and ready to rock. And it was Whitesnake and Aerosmith. And on the road over, I'm watching them talk about Robert Johnson and Lead Belly and Muddy Waters and just listening to these amazing icons. And then about 40 minutes outside of London, Tyler looks at me and goes, Lon, are you going to tell a story? You worked for Larry Flint, for God's sakes. So I said, well, I do have one story. And about 4 years prior, I was privy to observe these videotapes that were brought to me when I was editing Hustler magazine. And me and a fellow who you had on here recently, Alan McDonnell, he was an editor at Hustler. We worked together. I called him into my office to look at these tapes. This guy from Missouri brought him in. And they were of Chuck Berry.
Yeah.
And we sat in rapt, nauseous attention, fixated by these videos of Chuck doing the most heinous things, allegedly, to girls. And one of the scenes had to do with him, and I depict it as eloquently as I can in the book, where he swallows her breakfast, so to speak.
After it's been digested. Oh, man.
So I tell, but this is the reason, this is not a scatological tale. The reason is Jimmy Page loses it at the punchline.
Loses his breakfast?
No, he loses it and he laughs.
I can't imagine what that's like.
And anybody who, like, everyone on that bus knew Jimmy.
Yeah.
It's out of his character to just roll over and bust up.
Yeah.
So he's losing it. And I become, for the next 20 minutes, the hero of the bus.
Oh.
As we're walking down the steps and all the kids are waiting and we're driving into the backstage area, his roadie opens up the bottom of the bus, pulls out that Hammer of the Gods Les Paul case that has played every riff known to man, and Jimmy looks at me and goes, Lon, you want to carry me guitar in? You talk about almost famous moment.
Nice.
And that was it. I was floating, man.
Isn't that wild though? Like when you're around your heroes, that something that, you know, they would pay, like, to carry someone's guitar. It's like, yes, I will.
Oh no, I was looked at like Jesus when I was walking into the site.
Yeah.
Like, what? I'm holding the Grail.
Yeah.
So this is a boring question, but how come so many albums are done at Donington? Like, I could have a whole Donington collection wing of my CD library.
Because Donington, Sharon Osbourne created the concept of the Rock Festival, of the Monsters Festival. It didn't really work in America until Ozfest, till she resurrected her own husband to go out and make the big cash.
Ozzy, get up!
Ozzy, we can do this in America, but you have to perform.
I don't want to perform anymore. We have millions of dollars. Our children will get all messed up and have to go to rehab.
It doesn't matter. We need a bigger house and more maids.
Anyway.
And a TV show on MTV.
But her father was like a huge manager, right?
Yeah, he was big.
Yeah.
I mean, she was born into it. But Sharon was truly a visionary. She used to manage artists like Lita Ford. I mean, before, she always had Ozzy, but she had other acts. And this concept of having a festival in England, it's genius, because the punters over there live for the gathering.
Right.
They don't judge you on your hit single or your image. They will go into the middle of nowhere. They'll find a way. They'll take trains and buses or hitchhike. And they will. And this is why Reading Festival and Knebworth Festival, why the UK, all over Europe, they can gather the masses. It's just tribal there.
They come. Yeah, the tribes come.
They come, man. It's
so
huge.
I was reading the part of the book. Like, I had the exact same reaction to Nirvana's Nevermind that you did. That when, but you got it before it really got huge, right? The CD.
Donington.
Did you?
The after party for the 1990 Monsters of Rock. There was this gig in London, and Metallica was throwing his private little gathering of just their English friends. And Kirk Hammett goes, Lon, you heard Nirvana? And I said, nope. And he pulls out this cassette with like four songs on it, which is a, like an advance of what's coming out in a couple of months in America. And he plays me, and I hear Smells Like Teen Spirit.
And you're like, what?
And you, you have to be brain dead not to first get the riff.
Yeah.
But what's deeper is this isn't like anything out right now.
Yeah.
Because don't forget, this is the moment in history where hair is God.
Right.
Scorpions, Motley, Whitesnake, Poison, Warren. You were bad. You still had a multi-platinum record on Billboard.
Yeah.
Because MTV embraced your follicles.
Embraced the hair.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And the ballad. Don't forget the power ballad.
Uh-huh.
I mean, if you had a power ballad, you got spins, it's done. Your record was platinum.
So this was complete shit.
Here comes Kurt, yeah. The Reaper.
Yeah. The death of hair.
The Reaper, man. He was.
When can I think,
well, go ahead.
Can I ask, but what happened to guitar solos? Like, that was just like the end of guitar
solos.
But
that's what's so great about metal is like, they were, prog rock led to metal because it was all about virtuosity and musicianship. Metal, you had the axes, the heroes.
Yeah.
These guitar players that could just do these shredding, magnificent solos.
Yeah, I listen to it all the time. I have to.
Grunge was a whole different thing.
Yeah.
It wasn't about that.
It was back to rock, swappy rock.
Yeah, there was nobody put on anything other than what they were wearing that morning.
That stuff was
on stage.
I remember when Teen Spirit came out, like in New York. I was in New York at the time, and it was coming out of every window, everywhere. You walked down the street, it was like,
now it was in the ether, man.
That was such a sad part of the book where you're at a golf game with people that know. What is that story?
Okay, this is. First of all, every word in this book is true, and I don't know why I'm put in places where I am when things happen, but that's part of why I wrote a memoir, because, you know, who really cares about some of this stuff? But I guess fans care.
Of course.
I'm invited to play in this music industry golf tournament. I'm on the last dregs of my expense account, so I have, some of the biggest icons in the record business teeing it up at 9 o'clock in the morning in April of 1992, in April 1994, and I walk into the clubhouse at the Palatial La Quinta golf course. This is where Frank Capra wrote It's a Wonderful Life, out there in La Quinta.
It's in Pasadena, right?
No, it's out in the desert. It's just past Palm Springs.
Okay.
And all these guys are meeting for this tournament that Tom Wally, the president of Interscope, was throwing. And I look at, and there's David Berman, who's the head of business affairs for Geffen Records, and he's on the phone, and he's agitated. And I walk over to him. I go, hey, bud. And he shoos me away.
Yeah.
So I go out to the putting green and putt. 2 minutes later, Berman comes out. I was on the phone with David Geffen. They just found Kurt Cobain's body. He apparently committed suicide. And I went, what? Yeah, Geffen's really upset, and this is going to be a bad day. And so I call my office, and I tell everybody, because I'm running a rock magazine, it's going to be on the wire soon. MTV's going to be over this. But Kurt Cobain's dead. He took a rifle to himself. This is a really intense day.
Yeah.
It didn't stop everybody from playing their round of golf.
No.
including me. Because I was so bought into that whole thing. Like, oh, I got to play golf with these guys because it's important to keep the relationships going.
Was that the first indication that maybe your soul was eroding?
Well, that, and then a year and a half later, I go to work for Clive Davis, which is the true Faust chapter.
I know a guy who just started working with him. What happened
when
you...
I'm sorry.
Yeah, that was when you realized that you had actually met Mephistopheles? Like, you knew you were tight. It was one of those moments in your life where, like, this is a force of evil. What happened?
I don't consider him evil. I consider him unaware.
Okay.
And he showed me things, lessons.
Yeah.
Ego.
Uh-huh.
And the fact that rock and roll doesn't abide by any rules or scripts, which is why he failed in it for so long at Arista Records. But I was brought in all cocky. To like, oh, I ran a big rock magazine. I'm on MTV. I have syndicated radio show. I can sign rock bands.
Yeah.
I signed one band.
Who?
The first week I was there. Band called The Bogmen from Long Island,
New
York.
I know The Bogmen.
You do not.
Yeah, I remember The Bogmen.
Wait a minute. Wait, isn't that Billy Campion?
Billy Campion's in The Bogmen.
No!
Yeah. We're friends with Billy from New York.
Oh!
Billy and Chris.
You signed to Bogman?
Billy is the biggest star I had ever seen that nobody ever knew.
He's still
hilarious. He's one of the funniest people you'll ever meet.
He's making a very weird movie. I mean, that whole story is weird. And he now goes under the pseudonym of Vic Thrill. It's his alter ego character.
Mark. But what synchronicity that
right.
is.
but they started jamming with that Hasidic guy.
Yeah.
And now Tina Fey bought the movie rights from Billy.
Yeah, that's Billy. He's hanging out in subways, busking and playing with homeless musicians for the last 8 years.
You know his brother Chris?
Of course.
Chris is outstanding.
Knockout drops.
Yeah, the knockout drops.
Like my family, man. When you look at
Chris, is hilarious.
Is there a lesson?
They're both funny.
What is the higher purpose for everything? To fail at a record company, to not sign, or to get to know extraordinary people? They're like my children, this band. All of them. I talk to them all still. All the time.
Billy Campy's just a riot because you just never know.
He's going to show up.
He's wearing upside down glasses and maybe a dress going, hey, how's it going,
but
man?
You know, Clive loved him.
Yeah.
But we were just trying to sell them like they were a top 40.
Why the hell didn't they make it, man?
It's in the book.
Because he's still got a pretty good following. The Bogmen have a good following. I get Vic Thrill emails all the time. Hang out a minute. And we got one more segment, but why don't you hang out?
Thanks.
And we're talking to Juan Friend. The book is... Life on Planet Rock. Mishna Wolf's here. Jim's still here. There's a party going on in the booth. There's ice cream if you want to come down. But it'll be too late for the ice cream by the time this is on.
I wonder if he's still with that girl.
Let's wait till we get off. He might be with that girl. Let's call him. Go ahead, Jim.
That riff saved Mark's life in the desert.
That's
yes.
right. I high-fived Axl Rose coming out of the Pink Dot on Sunset.
Nice.
Yes. That was my big touch, my big brush with fame and Axl Rose. It was one of those moments where I walk in, he's walking out, and for no other reason because I could, I went, Axl! And he high-fived me. And then there was a time that I was with Sam Kennison and Tommy Lee in my bedroom at the at the house behind the Comedy Store, and we were about to do some blow.
Yes.
And I thought to myself, I said, "What would every 15-year-old kid in this country want to do right now?" And I said, "Hey, Tommy, can we do the blow off the back of my Telecaster?" And he's like, "Yeah." So there we were. I was passing around my Telecaster thinking, I'm living a teenager's dream. Too bad I'm 30 and a loser. All right.
Were you at the Wild Thing shoot?
No. Okay. I was out by then. I had lost my mind on cocaine, and me and Sam had a falling out. So our...
but he's dead and you're here.
I'm still alive, and I've got an appointment to pee on his grave. Look, Lon Friend is here. Not so zen, me, but the
you
book
can't
is
take me out of my space.
Life on Planet Rock. We've had a lot of fun. Mishna Wolf is here. Her show, August 4th and July 28th. I'm down at the UCB Theater.
8 o'clock.
8 o'clock. We'll get a dispatch on that. Tomorrow we're going to be down at Democracy Fest at the San Diego State University campus. Howard Dean's going to be there. Robert Greenwald, Maxine Waters, Al Franken, and out of all those people, I think we're going to interview Jim Croce's brother. How the hell did that happen?
Wow.
I don't mind
that. That's marquee.
Funny.
You know him? Jim Croce, that's way off of your radar.
Well, I loved Jim Croce when I was growing up.
If I could save time in a bottle.
If words could make wishes come true.
Okay, good. I'm glad we got that. But so that's
better than the first version.
Yeah, we're going live tomorrow night if we all make it. And we'll see who's going to be there. Again, Zoe and Pedro, thank you for the ice cream. We made it through this thing without freaking out on ice cream. Right now, these are Jim's picks, folks.
Hey, don't blame me. They're great, though.
Yeah, Jim picked the jokes today. So let's do the short order news. And Mishan, will you eat the Pop Rocks now? Zoe sent some Pop Rocks.
Okay. Wow.
Can I hear it on the mic, though?
Chandler Elementary School, 1967.
Oh, yes. Pop Rocks. Yeah, just keep that going if you can. Jack Kevorkian, whose failing health may deny him a chance to be paroled, said he still believes in assisted suicide, but would not choose it for himself. Kevorkian says he gets wistful for the old days, especially when he hears the long beep for the emergency broadcast system. You picked that one? That's good. Kevorkian is of Armenian descent. That's why he is the only prison. He's in the only prison with a fountain in front.
Nice delivery.
Okay. I didn't read him. Suicide is a big taboo in this country. The state that puts more people to death than any other developed country doesn't want people killing themselves unless it's a slow result of their food, air, and water. You wrote that one, didn't you?
No, I didn't write.
Oh. How's that Pop Rocks going? I think it's actually...
Wolf's killing herself right now. Yeah.
Where the hell is the other setup for this? Oh, police beefed up patrols around national landmarks Wednesday, a day after the District of Columbia's police chief declared a crime emergency in response to a string of violence that included the killing of a British activist. The crime has been so dangerous around Washington's famous landmarks, several men have experienced Vietnam Memorial War flashbacks. Vietnam Memorial Wall flashback. I don't even bother with this. How you doing, Wolf? You all right? Oh, no. Do you need water? Oh, stop it.
That's toxic.
Oh, you got Coke? Not... Coke and Pop Rocks.
Wow, that's great. So you're macro, huh? Right. It's good meeting you, Greasy.
A lot of yin in the Coke.
Yeah, totally.
Wait, hold on. Japanese spouses can have their vows of love launched into outer space and stored there for the next year as long as they buy platinum wedding rings. Men love the idea since most see marriage as being sucked into a lifeless black hole.
So, did you watch Supergroup with Ted Nugent?
I live Supergroup. I was still living in Las Vegas, and I went to the house on two occasions.
Oh, man, that was the greatest show.
Great. Scott Ian's one of my oldest, greatest friends in the rock.
I got band. Anthrax tickets.
Totally.
About Anthrax tickets.
Dude, I'll hook you up for backstage.
What's happened?
I'm Mark Maron, and this has been the Pen Open show. Tomorrow we'll be live in
will you really
San
hook
Diego.
Me up with that?
So hooked.
The penultimate show.
Laminate.
It is penultimate.
Yeah.
Yeah. Penultimate show.
She's laminated, dude.
I know. You don't gotta tell me.
For Anthrax and Rob Zombie.
Who got you into that? Am I going to that? What the hell's going on,
Wolf? I'm going with Richard Potter. I asked you if you wanted to go.
How the hell does this happen? You're going on a date, and you've got laminates, and I'm not even... When is this
happening? I'll go, too.
Did you hear me?
I'm taking Ellen, the documentary filmmaker.
Sure, take my wife, please. Did I just say that? Yeah?
Everyone needs a little metal.
Laughing Andy, Tina... Mark Grau, Kathy, thank you for everything you've done for us here. We're going live tomorrow. You guys have been great. Thank you, Juan.
Thank you.
Enjoy. We'll talk later.
Yeah.
Tomorrow live, San Diego. Good night, sheeple. All right, man.